Several questions were debated in different forums this week, but they all intersected with the question of presidential power. Can the government hold an American citizen without charge because he's been declared an enemy combatant? Does the vice president have to say who advised him about his new energy policy? How would it go when the president and vice president met with the 9/11 commission? And why were they there together instead of separately? All of those questions connect to the exercise and oversight of presidential power. Joined by a couple people now, Stuart Taylor joins us in our studios. He's a columnist for the National Journal and a contributor to Newsweek magazine. Thanks very much for being with us.
Nice to be here.
And from the campus of the University of Chicago, we're joined by Cass Sunstein, who's a professor of law at the university there. Professor Sunstein, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And if I could ask you, Professor, this first. If you look back at recent presidencies, let's say since the presidency of Lyndon Johnson, when has presidential power been the greatest and when has it waned?
In wartime, it's been the greatest. So I'd have to say in the last few years, it's been exercised more broadly than before. Otherwise, there's been a pretty consistent pattern with Johnson and Nixon, who had a war, too. There were broad assertions of presidential power.
And Mr. Taylor, let me turn to you. With the advantage of hindsight, was a lot of presidential authority curtailed practically, politically, and even legally following the Watergate era?
Yes, I think, but most of it was fairly broad. We had the War Powers Resolution of 1973, which tried to limit the president's use of military force. It didn't succeed at that. We had the Independent Counsel Statute. I think congressional encroachments tend to reach their zenith when there are scandals.
Obviously, we could all toll them off. There was the Watergate scandal, and questions were raised about presidential power and presidential authority to keep documents within the executive branch. Then there was the Iran-Contra investigation under the Reagan administration. Then, of course, there were the investigations of President Clinton's conduct. How did these all contribute to, is it a body of law or a body of politics we're talking about?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and I'd want to distinguish them pretty sharply. There were times when President Clinton was severely weakened just politically because of the amount of time and effort he had to do to fend off the impeachment. And there were times when the Reagan administration was diverted by the Iran-Contra scandal. So we have to separate political weakening from legal weakening. And I don't know that the president was legally weaker, actually, functionally, after the post-Watergate reforms than before. So the Reagan administration had asserted a lot of legal authority. It did so in good faith, and legally they did plenty, and they had a very broad conception of what presidential power consisted of.
Mr. Taylor.
Yes, I think that's right. I think most of the weakening is politics. The Supreme Court hasn't designed very specific tests, and they always prefer to let Congress and the president sort of wrestle it out. And for example, President Bush, who came in wanting to restore presidential power, has caved in again and again and again. He didn't want a 9/11 commission. He ended up appointing a 9/11 commission. He didn't want to talk to them for more than an hour. On Thursday, he talked to them for more than 3 hours. He didn't want Condoleezza Rice to go up there. She went up there. So the politics seems to be what drives it. I think there's another countervailing trend that gets a lot less attention, but which is pretty important, which is rather quietly, presidents, including I think both President Clinton and President Bush, expand presidential power dramatically through their use of executive orders. President Clinton, for example, used his executive order power to bring huge quantities of Western lands under restrictions, federal protection. President Bush used his executive order powers to undo some of that.
Mm-hmm. What's the effect of a Republican Congress being in power at this time, do you think?
It's a big deal, the fact that it's a Republican Congress, because it means that assertions of presidential authority aren't going to be fought hard legally by Congress enacting legislation that limits presidential authority. And it also means there isn't going to be a lot of political fighting of presidential assertions of authority, as, for example, through hearings and subpoenas and general complaints and harassment.
I think that's right. If the Democrats controlled the House in the late 1990s, President Clinton would not have been impeached.
May I ask you both, gentlemen, is this push for presidential authority, whether it's asserting new presidential authority or reasserting in the minds of some presidential authority. Is it good? Is this the kind of a fight that needs to go on to keep government working and relevant to its times?
I would say it's first expectable that any president, when national security is threatened, his lawyers are just going to tell him, you got to make claims that push the boundaries a little bit. Mm-hmm. One thing that's very good is that President Bush, I think even his critics should acknowledge, has not been lawless or extreme in his legal claims. He might be wrong, but he's, and this is good, that he's followed the rule of law. He thought, for example, he could make war on Iraq without a congressional authorization. The Justice Department apparently said you can do that. That would really be pressing things, and thank goodness, from the standpoint of separation of powers, he did go to Congress before making war in Iraq. I think it wouldn't be good if the courts deferred to all of President Bush's claims, even under circumstances where national security is threatened, because that would unsettle the system of separation of powers.
Mr. Taylor.
I agree, and I think it's a fundamentally a healthy tension, and it's not as dangerous as it was, for example, in 1942 when President Roosevelt basically sent a message to the Supreme Court through his attorney general that he would defy them if they ordered him to hand over the enemy combatants who were from that war, the so-called German saboteurs. It's almost inconceivable now that if the Supreme Court finds fault with President Bush's position here that he would say, well, tough, I'm the president, and you can't make me do it. As long as it's a push and pull, I think it's healthy. I think the least healthy thing about it now is that Congress, particularly in wide areas of policy making, is kind of AWOL and is not participating in the fight.
Gentlemen, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stuart Taylor, columnist for the National Journal and a contributor to Newsweek, and Cass Sunstein, professor of law at the University of Chicago.